For Hess, and it's 5 minutes after 2. We're going to take up Senate Bill 150. As you can see, we do not have a quorum, but we are able to take testimony anyway. And if we have to take any action, it's possible that I could get one of the finance people to come down. You have present with you today, Senator, excuse me, Senator Calgary and myself, Betty Davis, Chair. And we will start with an opening statement from the person that's carrying this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
State your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Donnie Flegel. I am a legislative intern for Senator Davis, who is the sponsor of Senate Bill 150 relating to crimes at domestic violence shelters. A little background on this bill. On July 25, 2005, Representative Andrea Dahl witnessed an event at the Juneau Aware facility, hence SB 150 and House Bill 213, responses to that experience. Domestic violence is a serious, significant, preventable public health challenge. Alaska has the distinction of being in the top 5 states for per capita domestic violence rates, and Alaska's women are being killed by their partners at the rate of 1.5 times the national average. In 2005, Alaska shelters provided services to 8,793 clients. This bill will not solve this social ill. However, it will bring attention to protecting victims of domestic violence and will serve to draw the public's attention to the need for social change and the responsibility we have as citizens to protect the most vulnerable of populations. Over time, this learned behavior will change when it is generally known that such behavior can result in additional time spent incarcerated. Anchorage has seen that over time, rape is committed without the use of weapons, because it's known that should a weapon be used, the stakes go up considerably. This legislation will give the courts the ability to impose additional time beyond the presumptive sentence for felonies committed on the premises of a shelter or a facility providing services to victims of domestic violence or sexual assault. Passage of Senate Bill 150 provides a tool that can be used to send a message that crimes committed on the premises of a shelter or a facility providing services to victims of domestic violence or sexual assault are deserving of the maximum allowable punishment, and that the safety that is expected in such an environment will be enforced and respected. The language in this bill was left purposely broad, allowing the courts of each jurisdiction to determine the definitions of facilities and services. If such a word as residential were to be added, it would eliminate STAR, a rape crisis center. It is not tied to particular facilities or services. Victims receive services in other places and are entitled to protection. In rural Alaska, there are recognized safe homes which do not receive funds from the Council on Domestic Violence. In this instance, again, the courts determine the definitions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We also now have a full house as far as the Hess Committee is concerned. And I'd like to say that Senator Dyson, Senator Thomas, and Senator Elton is now with us. They just had the overview of Senate Bill 150. We do have people that's online, and I think there's a few people here in the audience.
I have a question, Madam Chair.
Excuse me, yes, I didn't.
And, my time is really constrained here, but
yes.
As a part of the trafficking bill that was introduced, the cops want a place where they can put young girls who are being prostituted. It's safe without arresting them. And these gals will not always be having been beaten, I'm hoping that we can get somebody to tell us if the shelter they're going to be at, probably going to be Booth Memorial's new facility, if somebody committing an offense would be able to prosecute it under this bill at that place, because they're not, technically, I guess, because they're underage, they are the victims of sexual assault. Maybe that answers the question. But it...
I'd have to let legal speak to that, because I wouldn't be able to answer that, but...
Yeah, and maybe it can come up later in the discussion.
Well, he's here now, so...
He's the author of my bill.
You want to state your name for the record, please?
Hi, I'm Jerry Luckup, Legislative Counsel for the Division of Legal Services. Could you restate your question? I didn't
sure.
get all of it.
So the cops are wanting to have 13 beds every night where they can put a kid in protective custody without booking them, and in order to protect them from the pimps. So I'm just wondering if the language here where it says victims of domestic violence or sexual assault would cover those underage girls who would be there, and they, because they're underage, do they qualify as being a victim of sexual assault?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, if they are victims of a sexual offense, whether it's sexual abuse of a minor or sexual assault, then they would be theoretically covered under this bill.
Yeah, I thought so. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
You're quite welcome.
Thanks. Sure.
Yes, Senator Cowell, you have a question also?
Yeah. I was wondering where is the big... I'm from Anchorage, and how common these are in Alaska, and what is it in Anchorage, the biggest... city, the most assault, or and also I'd like to know what security procedures are in these shelters, if any.
I can't really speak to Anchorage. I have a little familiarity with the one here in Juneau, because as a member of the fire department here, I've responded to fire alarms there quite a bit. It's secured, as in locked doors, and you know, it's not super easy to get in.
What I would like to do.
Mr. Badgick, she's here. She is in charge of the shelter program here in Juneau. She could address that also. Usually these are secured facilities, it is what people try to do. It's just that in many areas of rural Alaska, it is not any more than someone's house. I wrote this in a manner so as to get at the original sponsor's goal of reaching not just these, you know, these the larger shelters, but also these smaller ones too, that would theoretically fit the definition that I provided in the bill.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And there, it's my understanding, but I just wanted to confirm, there's no presumption or requirement that a restraining order or any type of protective order has to be in effect in relationship to this bill.
No, this bill merely provides, I wouldn't say merely, but it only applies to someone that is convicted of a felony offense. And it's an aggravating factor that allows the court, when they find the existence of this aggravating factor, in this case, actually, it'll be a jury finding the existence of the aggravating factor. It allows the judge to sentence the offender up to the maximum penalty for the offense. So this allows the court to leave the presumptive range that we have for the offense in statute and go all the way up to the maximum for the offense.
Thank you.
All right. If there's not another question, I want to give my apologies to Representative Dole, who's in the audience with us, and I didn't mention that. She is a prime sponsor of this bill on the House side, and the bill that you're hearing is just a mirror of that bill. And I want to give you the opportunity to come up if you like. We have space up front for you to come. Or
thank you. I'll sit back here, and you have some wonderful people to testify today.
So okay. All right. Are there any other questions from committee members? We'll move on with the testimony then, because people's time is limited. And we'll start with Linda Stanford.
Hi, my name is Linda Stanford, and I'm the program coordinator for Arctic Women in Crisis, which is a domestic violence sexual assault shelter located in Barrow. And I'm so excited to have this opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill, and I'm calling on you to support it. We must hold the counters accountable. We hear that all the time, but here is actually an opportunity to do it, where we can provide stiffer penalties for folks who don't respect safe homes and don't respect shelters. As we like to call AWIC, we call it our safe haven. You know, security or safety must be one of our primary goals. We have children who arrive at our doors, their eyes are just round and they're full of fear. They're hiding behind mom. And safety has to be one of our primary goals. People will often ask me, Linda, what is it? What's the main thing that you do? And I will tell them, we provide safety. And if we can't provide safety, we are failing these women and children who come to our doors. Last July, we had a really serious abuser and perpetrator who was stalking our building. He had been spotted several times. We had reported it to the police. And in July, in Beryl, you have 24 hours of daylight, or approximately 24 hours of daylight. Anyway, in the broad daylight, he proceeded to beat in the windshield of another client's vehicle, which was parked outside of our shelter. This client, reportedly, he was angry at her for giving his partner a ride, stood out there with a hammer and beat it in. So, you know, he's mad at her for giving his partner a ride, so imagine how angry he is at the AWIC staff for providing safety for this individual. There were numerous additional incidents of him confronting or threatening AWIC staff, but, and so our safety has really been put in jeopardy, and we, you know, it's been really scary, I'll just say that. But I wish I could adequately, you know, describe to you how this additional trauma impacted the women and children staying here at the shelter during that time. They, you know, they had gone from being, when they first arrived, they're very scared. And generally within a couple of days, they're, you know, they start to relax, they start to have fun, they start to play. You'll see them out at the table laughing. Well, it just shut it down. People were so scared, they were looking out the windows. And all of a sudden, this was no longer a safe place. And it really had a tremendous impact on people staying here. You know, I'm not sure the exact time frame, but I think it was approximately 4 years ago. We had another perpetrator try to break into the building. He was coming through the front door. I was fairly new at the time. I would not do this again, but I did do it. I was holding the door while he's trying to come in, screaming for a staff member to call 911. And she was so afraid, she forgot to dial 9 to get an outside line. And so she's like, no one's answering. And I'm thinking, what do you mean no one's answering 911? So anyway, we did change our policies and procedures and our emergency plan to include dial 9 and then 911. But, you know, he almost got into the building before the police could arrive to offer us assistance. But, you know, We do have locked doors. We have cameras on the outside of our building. Could someone get in? They could. That's a fact. But what concerns me so much as a rural provider, I have safe home volunteers, and we have 10 safe home volunteers with AWIC. And these are individuals who open their homes any time of the day or night to take in victims of either family or sexual violence. And there's so few resources in these villages, and sometimes they're terrorized. You have a letter, I believe, from Nellie Sears, who is a safe home volunteer from Point Hope, and she describes one incident, and that's just one incident. Point Lay, we had a volunteer talk to us about a perpetrator who, for 2 days, just kept coming and beating on the house all during the day and the night, and he was smart enough that he would get away before the police could, you know, catch him. But just terrorized her, and she, you know, considered, you know, stepping down and not being a volunteer. So abusers do know how exactly where the line is. They're very good. Perpetrators, criminals are very good at coloring within the lines. They know where the limit is. And if we send a strong message that this is not going to be tolerated, that if you go onto a known, you know, or to the grounds of an unsafe haven or safe shelter, that there are consequences for that. I think it would be such an important message to send to the victims that we are going to help protect you and that we're going to help the shelters in protecting you by sending this message. So I, in closing, I just would really like to ask you to please seriously consider this bill and to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to call next on Don Shirill.
Madam Chair, my name is Don Shirill. I'm the Director of Client Development for the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Thank you for this opportunity. Over the years, tribal leaders of the interior Alaska villages have passed numerous resolutions at TCC's annual convention focusing on the need to provide safety to residents of rural Alaska. Unfortunately, women and other victims of domestic violence who reside in Alaska's rural communities have nowhere near the access to the protection and services afforded other Alaska citizens who reside in the state's more metropolitan areas. Many victims of domestic violence living in remote villages of the interior rely on local safe homes, which have been established through federal funding obtained by their tribal governments under the Family Violence Prevention and Services Act. Local domestic violence, local individuals who work with their tribal government to provide a safe place for victims of domestic violence do so with the knowledge that they have little or no backup from state law enforcement and only limited support from its judicial system in the event that a perpetrator elects to violate the haven they provide to victims and children. SB 150 is a step in the right direction and at very least sends a strong message that the consequences for felonious acts perpetrated at a shelter or safe home can and should be based on what they really are, escalated acts of violence which can result in harsher penalties. The Tanana Chiefs Conference strongly supports SB 150 and asks you to move it out of committee and to support its passage into law. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? We thank you for your testimony, and we do have several other people. I do want you to know that there has been no opposition to this bill. It's receiving great reviews and should be able to move this bill. It was not my intention to do it, but if we get through with the testimony today, we do have a quorum here. It's possible that we could move it out of the committee and to the next committee. At this time, there are some people here. Chris, would you not pronounce your last name?
Yes, thank you. Yes. Chris Ashenbrenner, and I am the interim director, or no, I'm not that. I'm the interim program administrator at the Council of Domestic Violence and, on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And you do have a letter in your packet, which I wrote on behalf of the council, and so I won't reiterate all that except to say that I was at AWARE, working at AWARE when the incident that was previously mentioned came about, and I just felt, and it was terrifying for everybody concerned, as many shelters, AWARE has a administrative side that you enter before you enter the shelter side, and so there's two levels of security to go through before you can get into the shelter portion of the facility, and this perpetrator only got into the administrative side. I just wanted to make that clear. But it was still very traumatizing for residents as well as staff as well as his victim. And I felt afterwards that he did not have a consequence to that for that. And as many domestic violence, all perpetrators of domestic violence, he was completely in control the whole time after he banged the door open and came in and threw the table and was very, very, very scary. The minute he realized his victim was going to go with him, his whole demeanor changed. And he was very calm and quite nice. And I thought if he knew that there was an extra penalty for that action, I thought perhaps he would have thought twice, because we knew from his demeanor that he was indeed thinking about what he was doing and the consequences, and he got what he wanted. But he didn't get held accountable to the extent that he should have. So that's my testimony.
Yes, just a minute. I think Senator Caldwell has a question of you.
Yeah, well, a comment. I am in charge of this billing, and security is one of the issues, and I've talked to the Commissioner of Public Safety of how we might have a little bit more security here, and he suggested tasers. And I'm not real familiar with them, but I know that they, I've seen them, the action on TV of them, and I don't think you have to be an officer to administer one, so it might be something you want to check out. I'm going to check. We had a slight incident here when our Senator Stevens was here. It turned out to be nothing but some talk, but we have the governor coming to our chambers. We have the Supreme Court judges and both of our senators yearly. So I'm ledge council chairman, and so we're thinking about how to discourage some of this. And so tasers, that's got a lot of discouraging
Through the chair. Thank you, Senator Caldwell. We will continue at the council to talk to our programs about how we can increase security all the time and find measures to make everybody safer, especially given the violence and that's happening all around us all the time. So appreciate all suggestions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now, Sarah Lynn? And I'll let you pronounce your last name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Sarah Lynn Tabachnik, the Executive Director of AWARE, Aiding Women in Abuse and Rape Emergencies here in Juneau. I'm here, of course, in support of this bill. When women come to residency at a shelter program, there is a higher expectation because of the need for safety. There is a specific high-risk population because of the domestic violence. So we're supporting this bill to recognize the increased need for safety and to hold perpetrators accountable. As you know, AWARE did have a man break in to our shelter in the summer of 2005. And as Chris said, he broke into the administrative side. And while, you know, the residential side was secure, it was pretty scary for many people, staff people as well. So thanks for considering this.
Thank you for taking the time and come and testify. Is there anyone in the audience that need to testify that I don't have name of? Are there any questions from the committee? At this time, I'd like to call back the sponsor to give any closing remarks briefly, and we will then consider taking the action on moving the bill out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Caldwell, you had a question about statistics. I went as far as the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice does not track aggravated assault crimes committed on shelters or facilities. The state of Alaska does not track it. The Uniform Crime Report does not track it, and neither does the National Crime Victimization Survey. So there are no numbers that are empirical that I could give you, short of the short poll that was done by the Council on Domestic Violence and certainly the folks that testified from Barrow. And that is about all I would add. SB 150 is deserving of quick passage and will certainly help Alaska's victims significantly. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your statement and your testimony there. I would like for the audience to know that this is her first time carrying a bill, and I think that she did quite well and has put a lot of work and effort in this. What is the will of the body, the committee?
I'd like to make a motion.
Yes.
To move Senate Bill 150 out with the accompanying fiscal note and with individual recommendations, and ask for unanimous consent.
So move. No one have any objection of that, and the bill will be moved to Judiciary. There is no note.
No fiscal.
It goes to judiciary. That's the last place it has to go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Here you go.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for coming. Glad you could be here.
Yeah, and I apologize.
Yes, I know you have to go.
Thank you.
We still have two people present on the committee, and we're going to take public testimony on the next bill that's scheduled so that we won't have to delay it any further. It's Senate Bill 8 that's going to come before us now. And the person that's presented is one of my bills. I'll ask my aide to come up. Okay, you want to state your name for the record?
Madam Chair, Tom Obermeyer, legislative aide, Senator Davis's office. Senate Bill 8 is an act relating to mental health patients' right to choose the gender of of hospital staff providing intimate care to the mental health patient and to the duties of hospital staff in caring for patients receiving mental health treatment. SB 8 provides that a mental health patient 18 years or older who is receiving mental health treatment and being provided intimate care at a hospital shall have the right to care provided by a staff member who is the gender that the patient requests. Many of these patients have been traumatized by sexual and or physical abuse in the past and are very sensitive to being touched or assisted by hospital staff who provide intimate care because the experience may trigger from original abuse feelings of fear, helplessness, distress, humiliation, and loss of trust in staff. The supervisor or manager employed by the hospital shall post notice of this right in a conspicuous place so patients know they may exercise this right when they are concerned about the gender of staff responsible for their personal intimate care. While it is understandable that a hospital may not always be able to comply with the requirement of gender, choice of gender in all situations and requests due to staffing schedules and shortages on particular shifts or duty units, the bill requires that the facility document noncompliance in the patient record that the intimate care was provided by a licensed or unlicensed member of the staff of a gender opposite that requested by the patient. This information might otherwise be ignored or lost. The information is also useful not only for confirming the good faith effort on the part of the institution to comply with the wishes of the patient, but for medical purposes as well in evaluating the effect on patient outcome, because individuals re-traumatized in this way are subject to chronic stress, which can worsen serious mental illness and result in symptomatic relapses and repeated rehospitalizations. Lastly, this bill will preserve information for inquiry into grievance procedures at mental health facilities under Title 47, which have been described as unduly burdensome for some patients and easily circumvented or limited because the language is too broad. I will also mention that the section analysis, which is very brief because it's a three-page bill, also says that it also requires certain actions of hospital staff to require privacy and to accommodate staff choice except as otherwise described. So there's a list of things that they're requiring that the facility attempt to do to provide reasonable privacy. You'll note in the attachments that there is from the Disability Law Center some indication from the Ninth Circuit and other courts that there is a basic right of privacy. It's supported on Article 1 of the Alaska Constitution, and this is another attempt to afford privacy to people who are at risk. Finally, in the fiscal note, I will mention that they state at the bottom of it that on page 2 that the bill is congruent with the department's desire to accommodate the gender choice of patients and to protect vulnerable populations from medically unnecessary invasions of privacy. Although there may be an increase in staff workload due to an increase in documentation, the effect is believed to be negligible and no fiscal impact is expected.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm going to ask a question.
Yes, you may.
What's the current practice of health care institutes or facilities? And you mentioned it might lead to staffing issues.
through the chair, Senator Cowdery, the main issue here is to attempt to have, yes, staff available. If one of the patients requests that a person of the same sex attend to them, for example, they will have a choice of gender. They may have been abused by someone of the same sex, and they want another person of another sex, but or gender. The reason for this is that these people often experience the same trauma all over again, and they consider themselves re-victimized if they're attended by those types of people. But as to the staffing issue, many of these institutions have very limited staff that have been trained to handle these matters, and they're attempting to bring to bear in this situation the fact that in some of the claims, if you read the documentation, that there has been no attempt to try to use other units that may have staff that could treat, that could deal with these people. There sometimes that they the claims are that objections are just ignored, and that and that they are given intimate care by someone that they would not choose of the wrong gender. Now this bill is a little different in that it does provide that in the record of the patient, which is really the only place that will ever be kept in a sure documented place, in the patient's record, which sometimes is opposed by institutions for other than medical facilities, you'll have a record of a person having been treated other than by a gender as requested. And this is so significant because it will be preserved forever that this happened. And then from a medical standpoint, if these people are considered later by psychiatrists or whomever as having been traumatized by the type of staff that they're being treated by, this is a matter of record that can be reinvestigated. At least it might, at least for medical reasons, to try to help determine what's going on.
Thank you.
And I noticed the fiscal note, it talks about the Department of Corrections. Are there other departments that this will impact?
I have a fiscal note that this is a component is Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Do you have that page? That's the only fiscal. Well, let's take a look here. I have Office of Operations, which is zero. Corrections is zero. We just received this two-page document this afternoon, as I recall. If you don't have it, I could show it to you.
You got it.
And that's where the language is provided that presumably wouldn't cause a change in staffing. And I would only assume that this could be partially affected fairly easily if there were, in fact, other units that could provide staff that could come in on an occasional basis to help with this problem.
I'd just like to add to the comment that you just made. When there are problems in many, many institutions, and particularly in psychiatric hospitals where there might be a problem and they need assistance, they call for other people to come down from other units. And usually it's an emergency type situation. You might have to restrain someone, or someone might be trying to get away, or then they would call people and they would come. That's the same kind of example that you're saying, that you don't necessarily have to depend on the people that's on the floor to provide a service. It might be somebody that you could use for some other department or some other division or some other floor that can come down and keep that patient happy by providing them with what the request was, rather than saying they're not able to do it. We do have some people signed up to testify on this bill. And do we have anybody in the audience here to testify? We'll go to online, and we have Faith Myers. Are you there?
Yes, Madam Chair.
I'd like to say that we're sorry that we were late getting started today, but we had long session today, so we had to be late starting. But thank you for being there.
Thank you. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Committee members, my name is Faith Myers. I support the passing of Senate Bill 8 as written. I have an avocation in mental health advocacy. In the past, I have been in acute care psychiatric facilities as a patient in Alaska, Washington, and Nevada. Also, as an advocate, I have contacted psychiatric hospital administrators in Maine, Maryland, Nevada, Alaska, and Washington, looking for best practices. There is such a thing as unnecessary traumatization of psychiatric patients in a psychiatric facility, especially in facilities in states that look for shortcuts. It is the rules and statutes of the state that reduce the amount of trauma and recidivism. We fully understand the idea of a psychiatric emergency when gender choice may not be able to be provided. What we want to reduce is the unnecessary traumatization of a psychiatric patient who is reasonably cooperative. The percentage of women in acute care psychiatric facilities who have a history of sexual abuse and/or physical abuse in their past is somewhere between 51% and 98%, respectively. The figure for men is a little bit less. To a person with mental illness, it is certain he or she feels re-victimized when he or she is given intimate care against their will by the gender of the person who sexually abused him or her in the past. There are three or four hospitals in Alaska that do civil commitment. And there are numerous other ones that do three-day evaluations that stretch out into 7 days. This issue cannot be dealt with by working to change each hospital's policy. Change needs to be done by state statute. I would like to briefly explain the support letters in favor of a bill for gender choice of staff for intimate care. The following letters of support should have been provided to you. 1. Anne F. Jennings, Ph.D., trauma-informed systems consultant, has background knowledge of trauma in acute care psychiatric institutions. She also has a personal connection. Her daughter was in and out of psychiatric institutions from the age of 13 to 32 when her daughter committed suicide in a psychiatric institution. 2. Erin S. Wolf, M.D., M.M.D. Dr. Wolf has over 30 years of experience in treating psychiatric patients from children to adults. 3. NAMI Anchorage. Their board members have personally been in psychiatric institutions and had family members in psychiatric institutions. 4. Alaska Mental Health Consumer Web. Their board members also have a wide range of experience with psychiatric facilities. 5. The Alaska Mental Health Board. 6. Disability Law Center. 7. Psychiatric Rights. All told, there are probably 50 or more board members that voted that a gender choice of staff for intimate care bill should be passed, many of them experts in the field. Senate Bill 8 only requires psychiatric institutions to make a good faith effort at giving gender choice of staff. In closing, I am asking you to pass Senate Bill 8. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I also want to say to you that we appreciate the help that you've been giving us on this bill. And we do have all the letters that you stated in the file. And there are some others that was not mentioned. We do have a letter from Jim Gostein as well. And there's probably several others that I didn't look at yet. We do have someone else to testify. And we'll go to the next person. Dorcille Collins?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dorrance Collins, and I support the passing of Senate Bill 8 as written. Post-traumatic stress disorder is one of the most prevalent and costly mental illnesses in America. Not giving gender choice of staff for intimate care in inpatient settings is traumatic to many psychiatric patients and can add to the illness. In other states, some psychiatric facilities take providing gender choice of staff for intimate care very seriously. These facilities have policies that require the facility to schedule a portion of their workforce by gender. As an example, if there are five males on one unit and five female staff on another unit, policy would require the head nurse, when scheduling, to see to it there are sufficient men and women staff on each shift to provide gender choice. Also, in the larger hospitals with multiple units, if the required gender is not available for intimate care, facility policy would require staff to go to the next unit to try to find the requested gender. Units are often just separated by a door. These are all policies that we have been informed that the Alaska Psychiatric Hospitals and Facilities will not adopt, even when it's pointed out that adopting such policies does not cost money and it reduces trauma. In a recent Alaska Supreme Court decision, the justices stated there is a clear, unavoidable tension between hospitals seeking convenience, economics, and patient rights, which can manifest itself in patient abuse. The justice saw it as a given that psychiatric hospitals and units were going to take shortcuts and would, without regulations, deny psychiatric patients their rights. It is the laws passed by the legislature and the action taken by the courts that will force psychiatric hospitals to do the right thing. Almost without exception, those patients entering an acute care psychiatric facility have dementia and trauma in their background. And to a lesser extent, those patients entering evaluation facilities. Many have been victimized, some from childhood through adulthood. The percentage that has been sexually abused and physically abused is much higher than the rate in the general society. When psychiatric patients are not given gender choice, they feel they're being re-victimized all over again. As a civilized society, we can't leave psychiatric patient protection up to guesswork. We need to pass statutes. Passing Senate Bill 8 will give back to psychiatric patients a small amount of dignity and control they lost when entering a psychiatric facility. In closing, Senate Bill 8 only asks that psychiatric institutions make a good faith effort at providing gender choice of staff for intimate care. Adding more loopholes to the bill will make the bill less effective. So in closing, I'm asking you to pass Senate Bill 8 as written. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I also want to say that we do have legal service available, Jean Michelle, in case there is a question that anyone wants to ask. At this time, Holly, are you there?
My name is Holly Johanknick, and I'm a staff attorney with the Disability Law Center.
Just a minute, please. I think you need to get close to the microphone, and would you state your name for the record?
My name is Holly Johanknick. Can you hear me? Sorry, we're having a little technical difficulty.
Yeah, that's better.
My name is Holly Johanknick, and I'm an attorney with the Disability Law Center of Alaska. The Disability Law Center supports Senate Bill 8 and recommends its passage. I understand that you are all provided with a letter from the Disability Law Center. I'd just kind of like to go over a few of the main points. First and foremost, this bill would codify existing rights of individuals receiving mental health treatment that are not currently acknowledged or protected. The Alaska Constitution clearly recognizes the right to privacy as an important one, and additionally, the Ninth Circuit has held that the right to shield one's unclothed body from view, particularly from the opposite sex, is encompassed within the right to privacy. Although there will be a certain relinquishment of privacy by necessity when anyone is admitted to a mental health facility, that does not mean that a patient has forfeited all rights to privacy. Courts in other states and circuits have held that privacy rights of individuals receiving mental health treatment shall be protected to whatever degree feasible. Furthermore, sensitivity to the privacy rights of individuals receiving mental health treatment might further the treatment goals of some individuals. As you have heard, an unfortunately large number of individuals with mental illness have a history of physical or sexual abuse. Many such individuals are extremely sensitive to issues of privacy. A way to protect people from re-traumatization and reliving their past experiences is to offer them a choice regarding the gender of their staff providing intimate care. It should also be noted that in many circumstances, the type of privacy protections provided in Senate Bill 8 are already available to individuals incarcerated in correctional institutions. Individuals receiving mental health treatment should be entitled to at least the same degree of privacy as prisoners. A federal district court in New York, when deciding a similar issue, stated, that the patients are not convicted criminals, but instead are there as a result of civil commitments. Thus, their right to privacy may not be abrogated by virtue of their confinement in a state-run facility, unlike a prison inmate who has forfeited some rights in repayment to society. The patients are just that, patients. They are vulnerable and mentally ill. Basic decency demands that their privacy be respected to whatever degree feasible. Therefore, given the privacy protections provided in both the Alaska State and U.S. Constitution and the sensitive and important nature of mental health treatment, a mental health patient should be afforded the right to choose their gender on the staff providing their intimate care, and we recommend that Senate Bill 8 be passed. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. At this time, I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Yes, you may. Come forward, please.
Madam Chair, Senator Cowdery, for the record, my name is Angela Salerno. I'm the Advocacy Coordinator for the Alaska Mental Health Board. I was expecting my chair, Andrea Schmuck, to be off net, but something must have come up. So I just want to state that you do have a letter from my chair, Andrea Schmuck, in your packet.
Yes.
And I just want to echo the testimony of the previous speakers, and I also want to give a kudo to Faith Myers and Dorrance Collins, who are advocates extraordinaire. They've very appropriately and effectively been working with my office on this issue and others, and we strongly support Senate Bill 8. This measure will afford a psychiatric patient the privacy, respect, and dignity that any of us could expect at a time of extremely difficult stress and change. It'll promote a sense of safety, comfort, and security that can really aid in recovery. We think it's a reasonable expectation for a hospital, and of course it even provides a method for dealing with the issue if the staff the patient has requested is not available. So again, we strongly support this bill and urge its passage. Thank you.
Thank you much for your testimony. I'd like to go back to Holly. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
We would like for you to send to us your written testimony.
Okay, no problem.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that want to testify? We thank you for giving your testimony today. We do not have a quorum to take any further action on Senate Bill 8 at this time, but I want you to know that there is another meeting going on in finance that's called away three of our members, but they do have staff members present, and besides that, the written testimony will be given to them so that they may read what happened here at this hearing. This bill will be scheduled for another hearing shortly. And at this time, I'd like to close to public testimony if there's no other person to testify. Is there any other business that we need to address while we're here, the two of us? We won't take up any other actions at this time, and we'll just close the HES committee meeting today at 3:05.